Leaving the larger upholstered chair for Pop, my sister and I each sat on one of the plain wooden chairs in the small office of the Beeman Funeral Home on Middle Street in Plymouth, not far from the library where Mother had so often taken out her stacks of mystery novels. The Beeman Funeral Home was a family operation. Since 1895, according to a small sign on a polished wooden side table, and Miss Anne Beeman, a middle-aged lady with a clean and dry appearance, a grave but not unpleasant look on her face, sat at the small desk across from Pop. I had picked up one of the aqua and white pamphlets on the side table, titled What Everyone Should Know, and had glanced through its pages about estate planning, death certificates, and Social Security. For some reason, there was a drawing of the Jefferson Memorial on the first page, and at the bottom of each subsequent page, a different quotation from Jefferson, such as, quote, "The will of the people is the only legitimate foundation of any government," unquote. Miss Beeman must have thought Jefferson appropriate for a funeral home in historic Plymouth, known as America's hometown. The pamphlet reminded me of another pamphlet, You're a Young Lady Now, which I had gotten with my first package of Kotex sanitary napkins. The cover, pink and blue, featured a pigtailed girl in pants looking into a full-length mirror at an image of herself transformed into a sophisticated young lady wearing a dress. The cover was sprinkled with stardust. Each of these pamphlets introduced me to a new world, menstruation and death. Each tried to euphemize the messy reality of the body's natural processes. The Kotex pamphlet emphasized being dainty and fresh. The funeral pamphlet addressed only the clean paper documents surrounding death. But Miss Anne Beeman told us, "I have her out back where it's cool." Mother's body was to be cremated because it was cheaper than burial. Having lived through the Depression, Mother was what she had called tight as a tick, and in addition had spoken with disgust of the financial exploitation she'd read about in Jessica Mitford's book, The American Way of Death. We picked out the simplest, least expensive coffin in Miss Beeman's small showroom of glossy coffins, certainly one without a white satin pillow and lining. Once Mother's ashes were returned, there would be a graveside service presided over by the priest from Mother's Catholic Church. A few days after that service, Pop wrote to my oldest sister, who had been unable to come from Europe. "Your mother's body went to Boston for cremation on Saturday, and we buried the ashes in the plot where my brother and mother are on Monday morning with 12 to 15 people there. Thanks for the flowers, which were a rich and handsome sight. We put a few on the grave and took the rest home. As to your mother's death and me, I have known for a long time that her life would be short. Death will come to all of us, dear, and the sooner we come to a rational acceptance of that, the better we'll be able to handle deaths and the idea of death. In your mother's case, as in many others, the circumstances eventually come to a point where everyone, except perhaps the sick person, welcomes death as the best of several things which might happen. It would have been very difficult for me to have your mother lying as a vegetable with the heart still beating, and the expense was intolerable. I have almost exactly the amount of cash on hand to pay the last 2 months at the nursing home, drug bills, the hairdresser, the funeral director, etc., and that's all the cash I have." Pop wrote my sister that it was the expense of keeping Mother alive that was intolerable, not her suffering, her years of illness, the possibility that she might have been, as he put it, lying as a vegetable with a heart still beating. He decided this was a good time to finally tell my oldest sister about his girlfriend, Louise. "I am grateful that you want me to find someone else whom I love and who loves me, and I am grateful beyond words that I have found one. Louise and I have grown into a wonderful relationship and will live together, without marriage because of her alimony, which stops if she marries. We have had heartwarming approval and approbation from all our children. You are the last to know. Mother's estate took about 6 months to be settled. Pop was not going to inherit her trust fund because my grandmother Corny had specifically set it up to pass on to us children. But Pop told us it was rightfully his, if only Corny had liked him, so he would expect us to turn our shares over to him. My oldest sister was furious at him and refused. Pop responded that he would disown her. My sister's response made me wonder, for the first time, why Pop hadn't managed money better. I'd never thought about it, and I was used to doing what he wanted. And I thought, shouldn't the money really have gone to him? At first, I didn't dare cross him. He might disown me, too. But as it turned out, my middle sister and I gave him the interest from our shares for a time, but we did keep the principal. Pop was selling the house and moving to California to live with Louise in her new house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Frank continued to live in Mother's old room and work at the men's clothing store while he waited for his inheritance, which he knew had been coming. He repainted the downstairs of the house a jarring bright blue. On one of my infrequent visits to Plymouth, after Mother died and before the estate was settled, Frank surprised me with the gift of a pearl necklace in a white satin-lined leather case. He had a whole box of them, some new business idea. "For my baby sister," he said, laughing. I assumed the pearls were imitation, but discovered years later that they were real. After the inheritances were finally distributed, to everyone's surprise, Frank got married again. I never met this fourth wife, but Louise told me they bought a fancy car and a new house. Then, one evening, soon after they had moved into their new house, Frank left this wife a note, "I won't be home tonight or ever." He disappeared, and we never heard from him again. 5 more presidents had been elected since Mother's nemesis, Nixon, had resigned in disgrace and Frank had disappeared. I was lying in bed one night, nearly asleep, when the hair suddenly rose on my arms. I sat straight up. I had a thought that had never before occurred to me. Maybe Mother had been right when she claimed that Frank had tried to kill her. I had not looked back at Mother's death or that awful last year of her life. Witnessing her decline had been like watching her lower herself into boiling oil. When she died, I had been only 28, divorced, and a single parent. My own life and my own problems had occupied the 22 years that had passed since she died. Pop had died 10 years after Mother. I'd seldom even thought about Frank. By then, I had been married to Ben. I'd gotten my master's degree in social work, spent a decade working as a therapist, and written a number of books for children. Matt had grown up and was on his own, and my daughter Lucy was at home for her last year before leaving for college. I was 50, and for the first time, I had the opportunity to slow down to think about all that had happened in the past. I bought a used 4-drawer file cabinet and organized Mother and Pop's letters and all the family papers that had been passed on to me. I made a file for each year of my life. As I thought about Mother's accusation all those years ago, I realized that if I could read her medical records, I might be able to learn why she had been considered paranoid and, I hoped, put to rest the disturbing idea that Frank had tried to harm her. As a clinical social worker, I had been trained to assess patients' mental states, and I was used to reading medical charts. But it didn't seem likely that I could still get Mother's records. I figured I might as well try and sent a request to the hospital in Plymouth. After several weeks, when I'd gotten no response, I telephoned. A woman with a notable Massachusetts accent told me, "We've been working on your mother's records this week," adding, "I know that you're her daughter and all, but there's sensitive information, and we need you to sign a form before we can send you the records, okay?" Sensitive? I knew that term was used to denote drug and alcohol abuse or psychiatric information. And for a moment, I wondered if Mother had told the hospital staff some deeply hidden secret. Had she attempted suicide? Had Pop been physically abusive to her? Then I wondered why I chose those sorts of possible secrets and not others. What did I really know about my own family? I returned the form and waited impatiently for the records to arrive. Finally, after 10 days, a large manila envelope arrived in our black metal mailbox. I tore it open to find an inch and a half thick stack of photocopies of typewritten and handwritten records. Sinking down into the old red wing chair I'd inherited from Mother, the chair in which she had so often read her mysteries, I began looking over the records. Variously titled Personal History, Summary Sheet, Physical Examination, Operative Record, Consultation Record, Discharge Summary, and Outpatient Department, Mother's records were in chronological order, beginning with her first admission to the hospital in 1965 and ending only a few weeks prior to her death in 1974. The typist who had transcribed the records had made a number of obvious errors, the most startling one, a description of Mother's genitals as normal male instead of normal female. That certainly would have been sensitive information. But Mother had borne 5 children, and I had seen her naked many times. She was definitely female. That was a typo. In the earliest record, Mother, at 56, had been described as a well-nourished and well-developed white female about the stated age. But only 5 years later, as an elderly white female who appears older than her stated age, with evidence of weight loss and chronic illness. The initial records included energetic plans for her treatment. But by the time she was sent to the nursing home, the doctor had written, "The prognosis is extremely grave. No potential for rehabilitation." I just sat for a while, silent and sad, with her records on my lap. Then I continued reading and came upon the report written after Pop had taken her to the emergency room. "This is a 62-year-old white female who has had a long history of chronic lung disease, dependency on oxygen at home. The past 10 days, she's had increasing episodes of mental confusion. First of all, when she was out of touch with reality. Secondly, when she would appear to be confused as to time, place, and person. Third, when she had been hallucinating, seeing people around her that were not there, and also having delusions that her son or her husband were trying to kill her. In particular, she has accused her son of trying to do her in. She has also yesterday morning had an episode in which she spent about 15 minutes dipping her eyeglasses in a glass of milk, lifting them up, deliberately lapping them off, and putting them back in again, and repeating this episode. Tonight, she refused to take medications from her family at home and stated that she wouldn't do anything that they asked her to do and stated that she was afraid they were going to kill her. She was finally brought into the hospital for further evaluation and consultation with the psychiatrist. For details of her past history, see the old record." Mother's use of the term "do her in" reminded me of all those mystery novels she had liked to read. I went upstairs and rummaged through my file cabinet. I located the letter Pop had written me about taking her to the emergency room. He wrote, "Frank, your mother and I went to your sister's for a weekend on October 18th. We had oxygen troubles going up, and your mother got upset. She was already quite weak, and we made a bed-like thing for her in the back seat of the wagon and had the rear part full of oxygen tanks in our bag. She spent all the time at your sister's in bed, and by the time we got home on the 21st, she seemed exhausted. Soon after we got back, we began to notice a little paranoid spells and confusion. We took her medicines away from her, and now Frank gives her the daily ration in a little vial each morning, and we have a check table where we note when she takes what. She woke Frank and me up at 12:30 to tell me that he was trying to kill us both. She's normal this morning, but we have had one of these little spells about once a day for 10 days. She sort of drifts into them and then drifts out after a while, sometimes not remembering she's had them. They've been frequent enough so that I think this is going to be a continuing thing to cope with. The next problem is that we can't cope with it for very long at home. I've just told the doctor about last night's episode. He's going to call a geriatric psychiatrist whom I had to see my mother a couple of times. He says he has a hunch there might be an organically created psychosis because of using steroids over a long time. So that's the story at the moment, not a happy one, but there are resources to deal with it. Frank is being wonderful and absolutely indispensable. Pop had written me that, quote, she woke Frank and me up at 12:30 to tell me that he was trying to kill us both, unquote. But the hospital reported that mother had been, quote, having delusions that her son or her husband were trying to kill her. Why had Pop asked Frank to dispense her medicines and not done it himself? Why had he used the expression, a little vial of medicine? A little vial sounded like something else out of one of Mother's mystery novels. I visualized the arrangement of the rooms of that Plymouth cottage. How could Mother have managed, tethered to her oxygen tanks on the first floor, to wake Pop up past midnight in his second floor bedroom to tell him of her fear? She must have been really afraid if she had disconnected herself from her oxygen, walked through the kitchen, through the dining room, and through the living room to reach the bottom of the stairs and call out. Did she even have the breath to call out? Had she instead stayed in her room and rung a bell? How could Pop have heard that? Wanting only to wake Pop to seek his protection, she must have been unavoidably awakening Frank, too, since the small upstairs bedrooms were very close to one another and to the staircase. I had not known that Mother was disoriented about time and place, or that she had hallucinated, or what exactly she had hallucinated. The hospital staff had not directly observed her disorientation or hallucinations. They were simply reporting what Pop had told them. Had he told me to, and had I forgotten? Or had he never told me about it at all? It was clear that Mother's behavior had been bizarre, dipping her eyeglasses in milk and lapping it off? I put the records down on my lap. What reason would Frank have had to kill her? Of course, he knew that when she died, he was going to inherit his share of our grandmother's trust fund, $35,000. But Mother was obviously not going to live very long anyway. Had he decided he couldn't wait? When would Frank have had the opportunity to kill her? Pop was there. But Pop had left Mother in Frank's care when he took that first trip to see Louise, and he had taken other trips as well. He often left the house to do errands, so Frank had been alone with Mother many times. But what could Frank have done to her? Pop had written about how anxious Mother was about her oxygen. She couldn't turn the valves herself. Frank or Pop had to do it. What if Frank had simply turned off her oxygen? What if he had given her the wrong pills? Was it just a coincidence that she had seemed all right before Frank moved in? Even though he had lied repeatedly, deserted his first wife and child, married unsuspecting women and stolen their money, embezzled from an employer who trusted him, even though he was capable of being charming and sweet, just as he was deceiving people, that didn't prove he was capable of attempted murder. To kill his own mother? He would have to be heartless. But hadn't we seen that he was heartless? Pop had written me that Frank was being absolutely indispensable. Now I wondered, indispensable for what? Mother had been in the care of that nice doctor with whom she and Pop were friends. She'd worked as his medical secretary before she got sick. He would surely have noticed if anything was amiss. I decided to try to find him.